Thanks for joining us at North Coast Church as we continue on our series on David. To be able to prepare for today's message, we encourage you go to our website, northcoastchurch.com, to download the message notes. There you can also put in a prayer request or you can give online as well. Now let's join Pastor Larry Osborne for today's message.
You know, we keep reminding you that God is the hero of the David story. I mean, he's the one who reveals his unimaginable mercy and grace, keeps all of his promises, even when we don't keep ours. He never has any of his plans that are thwarted. He's the one to whom every knee will bow, whether it's willingly or unwillingly. It's going to happen. And he's the one who draws straight lines with crooked sticks. And as we've been seeing, in many ways, David is kind of the ultimate crooked stick. You know, he might have been a great warrior. He might have been a great king. But if you ask Uriah, he was the worst friend ever. If you ask Michelle, his wife, he was probably the worst husband ever. And if you ask his sons and daughters, I wouldn't be surprised if they pretty much said he was the worst dad ever. His parenting was, frankly, it was a lot like a reality show, a jacked up reality show, if you will. I mean, rape and incest and seething hatred. And that's just in the chapter we're going to look at today and the next couple of chapters we're going to see. And you might be wondering, like, why in the world is all this stuff in the Bible? Well, God puts it in there so we can learn lessons. There's a thing I like to call dumb tacks. And I put it this way. Everything you and I know was pretty much learned by dumb tacks, especially anything that has to do with life experiences. So the only question is, am I going to pay my own dumb tacks or am I going to let someone else pay the dumb tacks for me? And part of why God put some of the stories, like the one we're going to look at today, in the Bible is not because it's an example to follow. It's an example to make sure we don't follow. It's an illustration of the dumb tacks. And the passage we're going to look at has so much to it. I mean, it's got the extreme injustice where we cry out when we read it, like, God, how can that happen? And this passage and others explain that. It's got a passage that shows the horror of confusing lust with love and the tragedy that can bring upon somebody's life. And it also shows us a little glimpse into David's parenting. That's why I'm calling it How to Fail Parenting 101. We're actually going to circle back and look at other parts of the story next weekend. But today, we want to read this tragic story, a family tragedy of the worst kind. And what we want to do is we want to ask ourselves, what dumb taxes in David's life, in this passage and other passages, can we not pay as we learn the lesson? Because God, in the whole storyline of David, said, you need to know this one as well. So if you're not already there, I invite you to find in your Bibles, 2 Samuel chapter 13, and we're going to look at the first 22 verses. 2 Samuel chapter 13, verses 1 through 22. It's kind of a long passage, so buckle up. And as I said, it's got some horrific stuff in it. It's certainly not a PG passage, if you will. So here we go. 2 Samuel 13, verse 1. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. Now, this we're going to see later on when we come back next weekend. It's a one-sided fixation that's nothing more than lust. And he becomes so obsessed with his sister, literally half-sister, same dad, different moms. He becomes so obsessed with his sister, Tamar, that he makes himself ill. Now, she was a virgin. That means a young woman of marriageable age as well. And it seemed impossible for him to do anything to her. Now, Amnon had an advisor named Jonadab, who was the son of Shimeah. He was David's brother, a first cousin of both Amnon and Tamar, the two key characters in the first part of this story. And we're told he was also a very, very shrewd man. In verse 4, it says, he asked Amnon, why do you, the king's son, you're the crown prince. Why do you, the crown prince, the king's son, why do you look so haggard morning after morning? Won't you tell me? And Amnon said to him, I'm in love with Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. So Jonadab tells him this, verse 5, go to bed and pretend to be ill. When your father comes to see you, say to him, I'd like my sister Tamar to come and give me something to eat. Let her prepare the food in my sight so I may watch her and eat from her hand. So Amnon lay down and he pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to David, I would like my sister Tamar to come and make special bread in my sight so I may eat from her hand. And so David sent word to Tamar back at the palace, "Hey, go to the house of your brother Amnon and prepare some food for him." So Tamar went to the house of her brother Amnon, who was lying down, and she took some dough. She kneaded it. She made bread in his sight, and she baked it. And then she took the pan, and she served him bread, but he refused to eat. And he said, "Send everyone out of here." So everyone left him. And in verse 10, "Then Amnon said to Tamar, 'Bring the food here into my bedroom so I may eat from your hand.' And Tamar took the bread she had prepared. She brought it to her brother Amnon in his bedroom. And when she took it to him to eat, he grabbed her and said, 'Come to bed with me, my sister.' 'No, my brother,' she said to him, 'don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? What could I get? How and where could I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You'll be like one of the wicked fools in all of Israel. Please, please speak to the king. He will not keep me from being married to you, but don't do this.'" And then tragically, in verse 14, he refused to listen to her. And since he was stronger than her, he raped her. And then, and we'll dig into this much more next weekend, then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." "And no," she said to him, "sending me away would be a greater wrong than the horrific, terrible, damnable, godless thing that you have already done to me." But he refused to listen to her. He called his personal servant and said, "Get this woman out of my sight," and bolted the door after her. So the servant put her out and he bolted the door after her. Well, she was wearing an ornate robe, the kind of garment the virgin daughters of the king wore. And Tamar put ashes on her head and she tore the robe she was wearing. And she put her hands on her head and she went away weeping as she went. Well, her brother Absalom said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? Be quiet, circle, highlight, underline, for now, my sister. He's your brother. Don't take this thing to heart." And Tamar lived in her brother Absalom's house, a desolate woman. And when King David heard all of this, and this is what we're going to focus on today. As I said, there's so much more to this story. Pastor Chris is going to circle back next week and look at it through another lens, the lens of Amnon and Tamar. But today, I want us to look at verse 21 and 22 in particular. What we're doing is we're taking a look at what set the stage for the horrific things we see in this passage. And this is what we read. When King David heard of all this, he was furious. Period. That's it. He was furious. And as for Absalom, he never said a word to Amnon, his brother, either good or bad. And he hated Amnon because he had disgraced his sister. We're going to see as we read on for 2 full years, it's as if nothing happened, except for Tamar, with all the horror and the grief of such a godless, damnable thing happening to her. Why is this story here? I told you at the beginning. Because there's incredible lessons we can learn. We can look at it through the lens of Tamar, and it raises that whole question of, in this fallen world, where is God when horrific things happen to really good people? We can look at Amnon and see what happens when lust and love are confused and we let one control our life. And we can do as we're going to do today. We're going to look at David's pathetic parenting that set the stage for all that we just read. So on your note sheet, there's a section there that says How to Fail Parenting 101. And we're going to walk through 5 things that he did wrong. But I don't want to leave us today with, well, these are the things you don't want to do, because I think we learn from the bad example, but we also need that positive example that says, well, what do we do? So here's where I'm going today. We're going to look at the 5 things we can see in this story and other parts of David's life about the way he parented that set such a stage for such dysfunction and evil. And then I'm going to leave you with one simple summation of what we can do to swing the pendulum in the exact opposite direction. So here we go. How to Fail Parenting 101. Number one, set an example you don't want your kids to follow. Set an example you don't want your kids to follow. David's many wives in his pursuit of Bathsheba set a horrific example. He obviously had zero credibility or moral ground upon which to stand when it came to any sexual matters with any of his kids. So I want to step back and I want to talk for just a little bit about why the example we set is maybe as a parent, every one of you that's a parent right now or will be a parent, why it's perhaps the most important thing that you will ever do. Here's why the example is so important. Number one, what we are is what we'll tend to get. Now, I do want to highlight this phrase, and we'll circle back to it a little bit. It's what we are is not always what we will get. This isn't a fatalistic certainty. We can have power, as we're going to see in a few moments, through Jesus and turning our life over to him to break the curse. And some of you that are listening right now, you are absolute living proof of God's ability to take a cesspool background and create a living spring right out of it. He does that all the time. He's the God who forgives. He's the God who restores if we step over that line to follow him and we give him our life and let him do it. But truth be known, it is the basic pattern of life that only a fool is going to ignore and say, well, I'm going to be a lucky fool. I'll set a really bad example and somehow it won't be picked up. And part of the reason is this second thing that we're popping up here, and it is this. Our kids see it all. We've talked about this before. They always know the things that we think they have no idea. We think we've hidden them really well. They know that stuff. David's multiple marriages, his adultery with Bathsheba, they were not hidden from Amnon. And that sets the stage for this third thing that is why our example is so important. Because our kids are inclined, kind of like the word 10 there, the word inclined means it's not 100% of the time, but it is the pattern. Our kids are inclined to adopt our values, but not our boundaries. Let's think about David for just a moment. Amnon picked up David's view and value of women, but he didn't pick up his dad's boundaries. For David, the boundary in this lower view of women that he had was you have as many wives as you want, even though he was forbidden, especially kings, to have more than one wife. He also decided that, well, you know what? My view of women is under certain circumstances, I'll even go so far as adultery. That was his line. Well, Amnon, his boundary was not adultery and multiple wives. His boundary was incest and rape. You see, they're going to head off in the direction we head. That's pretty much the way it usually works. But the bad news is they don't always stop where we stop. They head further down the road. And it's why I encourage you so much, all of you that are parents, pretty much in all of life, if you're leaders in life, this principle Jesus talked about is true there too. When a student is fully taught, they become like their teacher. And the things that we are putting in the lives of other people, the fingerprints we are leaving on them are much more about what they catch, what is caught, than what is taught with our words. And that was a sad case with David. Now, I need a little sidebar disclaimer here, a very, very important disclaimer. Just as the curse of bad parenting can be broken through turning our life over to Jesus, the advantage of godly parenting can be squandered by walking away from Jesus. And I need to say this because I know right now listening are some parents who go, man, one of my kids or all of my kids have kicked the traces and gone totally away from the Lord. And I did everything I could to raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. And I want you to understand our responsibility is to set the example. But if there's not a fatalistic determination in that, they still have the freedom and they have to make their own choices. You and I have incredible influence, incredible influence. That's why the pattern of life is we get what we are. But just because we blew it doesn't damn someone to the same path we had. And when we did everything right, doesn't guarantee that everything will work out fine. One of the great passages that shows this is Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis chapter 1, for all of you that are new in the Bible and following Jesus, you've got who created it, our God. And then the second thing is what the world is supposed to be like in chapter 2. And then chapter 3, why it's not like that at all. You have what's called the fall of Adam and Eve, which brought sin and horrible things into this world. Now, what you need to remember about the fall of Adam and Eve when they turned and rebelled against God is this. They were in a perfect environment. And if you want to call God the parent with the patterns and rules he laid down and his provision, God is a perfect parent. And they did not have a propensity to disobey like we do what's called a sin nature. They didn't have it. Perfect environment, perfect parenting, no sin nature, and what'd you have? You had rebellion of the worst kind. That's ripple effect of it has impacted every human being, son and daughter of Adam, ever since, and will continue until the day that Jesus returns. Parents, a rebellious child doesn't mean it's all your fault. Now, you look like David. You set a bad example. You and I need to take a lot of the blame and the other things we're going to see. And on the flip side, great kids aren't proof that you were a great parent. But if we're honest, we can look back and see, did we play our part well or did we play our part poorly? Because without doubt, the most powerful influence that you and I have for good or bad in every area of life is the example we set. Now, here's the second thing. The second thing we see from David that we don't want to do, how to fail parenting 101, is get angry. Get angry. David was furious, period. You know the drill. Either you grew up in a home that was like that, or you had a friend or a buddy that grew up in a home like that. Lots of screaming and yelling. You know, you do something, you're grounded for 6 months, and all of this wrath that comes down, and then everything is back to normal in a couple of days. The problem with anger as a response to our children, especially the fury and the like, the blowing up sort of thing, is this. Our kids aren't stupid. If the pleasures of rebellion outweigh the pain of the consequences, they will continue to rebel. I had a buddy growing up who was, I can't tell you how many times he was grounded. If all of those groundings were put together, he to this day would still be grounded. But nothing ever stuck. It was just an explosion. It was an anger. It was a venting. And he pretty quickly figured out, you know, whether we were staying out way past curfew or what, doing things we shouldn't have been done, whatever it was, he's just doing the math, figuring like, well, is this pleasure worth being yelled at this amount of time? Is this pleasure worth the punishment that's going to be melted out because I'm going to be out on bail really, really quick? And he would make these decisions that way. Our kids aren't stupid. If they know our bark is worse than the bite, they get really good at tuning out the bark. They just kind of don't hear it. Parents, it's like some of you with little kids, and after a while, you just don't hear the fussing and whining. It's just like, it's all white noise. And that's what they do. What we need to understand is this. Anger is not discipline. Okay? Anger is not parenting. Anger is simply this, it's selfish venting. That's all my explosive anger is. Now, please hear me. Certainly there's a time and a place for anger, but discipline should never be flowing out of that anger. It needs to be appropriate to the consequences of the behavior, not tied and appropriate to the level of my frustration, my anger, the button to this push that just causes me to go off. Maybe you've heard this saying, you know, never discipline in anger. You heard that one? Like, that one always confused me a little bit. Like, what am I supposed to do? Save it up till we're having a good time? And then, pow, and come out with a discipline? Of course not. Anger is going to be a natural response. It's one of the responses of God. In our sermon prep meeting this week, it was mentioned that anger is one of the top things that we're told God does. God is loving, God does this, God does that. And his anger is an attribute that's right up there at the top. It's a righteous anger, and it's an anger that is appropriate to the situation, but in the anger is not a lashing out at us. In the anger against sin is the opportunity to come to Jesus, to have our sins forgiven, and then there comes a point where that anger lashes out. There's a different thing, too, about God's anger. We're made in his image, but his anger is always holy and righteous. Ours isn't. In fact, sometimes the things we blow up the most about are things that we did or things that we struggle with. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 26 to 27 puts it this way. In your anger, do not sin. It doesn't say never be angry. That's an unrealistic, crazy way to think about life. But it says this, in your anger, do not sin. And don't let the sun go down while you were still angry. Don't give the devil a foothold for that to seethe and steam up. And then it says this, that same book, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. Fathers, don't exasperate your children. There's nothing more exasperating than the blowing up parent who just goes everywhere. Now, after we go, well, listen, I just kind of blow up and then it's all okay. Well, you know what? So does a nuclear bomb. The damage of out of control anger is huge. Again, I want to be crystal clear. We can't avoid being angry, but we can control what we do with that anger. And for some of us, it's the old count to 10 or walk away or let your spouse be the one that carries out the discipline or whatever. But it does no good to be furious. What's needed is appropriate discipline. And that leads now to the third thing that David did. Do nothing. He was furious, but he did nothing. Now, apparently, this was David's pattern throughout life. There's only two verses in the Bible where we get any glimpse of his parenting outside of the stories, but where a statement is made. And the first one is here in 2 Samuel 13, 21, where with Amnon, the crown prince, he was furious, but he did nothing. And then in 1 Kings chapter 1, verses 5 to 8, Adoniah, who was at that point the crown prince, the oldest one living, next in line to the throne. He gathered together a group of people while David was still alive to set himself up as king because he was afraid that Solomon was going to become king. And here's what it says of him. It says that David never stepped up to rebuke him and ask, why do you behave as you do? He just never did it. Now, here's what we need to grasp. The failure to follow through with appropriate discipline is a sign that I love myself more than my kids. It's not a sign that, I'm just a softy. It's not a sign, I just love them so much, I can't stand to see them hurt. No, the failure to appropriately discipline our kids is a sign that we love ourselves more than we love them. Because it's only for two reasons. Either I don't want to be bothered, or I'd rather be a friend than a parent. Those are the only two reasons we don't discipline. Some of us, I just don't want to be bothered. Life, I'm too busy. This will pass, whatever. And others is, I don't want the kid to misunderstand me. I don't want my kid to not like me for a moment. And I want to guarantee you, when you discipline a kid, they never go, thank you. I so appreciate it. That was so appropriate. Obviously not. But if I love myself more, I'd rather my kid always like me and be my friend than take the risk to be a parent. You know, in God's discipline of us, he takes a risk. Just look back at your own life where you've seen the hand of God as you begin to go off in a direction you shouldn't, and he does what he has to do to bring you back where you and I need to be. We don't love that rebuke. In the moment, it never seems good, but it's because he loves us. He knows our holiness is far more important than our temporary happiness. And doing nothing is pretty much because we don't want to bring that pain and sadness to someone else, or we don't want that negative vibe back to us. We always want to be loved. You know why God disciplines us? God disciplines us precisely for this reason, because he loves us. Look at these passages. Revelation chapter 3, verse 19. Those I love, I rebuke and discipline. Not those I'm ticked off at, not those, you know, there'll be a judgment that comes, but God's love holds back his judgment as long as possible. We're actually told in the New Testament, that's why Jesus hasn't returned yet. It's not that he's slow to keep his promises, but every day he waits, someone who was once an enemy becomes a member of his family. That's the purpose, and that's what he's doing. No, the ones who get rebuked are those that he loves, because he's driving us towards holiness. Now, Hebrews chapter 12 is another passage that talks about that. The Lord disciplines what? The ones he loves. There we go. We got it once again. Get that little piece there. There, we got it. And he chastens everyone he accepts as a son. Now, catch this. If you and I are living a life and we're doing everything wrong and we don't find any discipline brought into our life by the Lord, what does that mean? Well, that means we're illegitimate. We're not his children. We are not true sons and daughters at all. You know, when I was in a restaurant when my kids were young and kids were misbehaving, which ones did I deal with? I dealt with my own kids, okay? If somebody was just misbehaving a couple of tables over, I guarantee you, I might talk to Nancy about it. I might roll my eyes. If it's bad enough, I might get up and ask for another table. But one thing I never did is I never went over there and disciplined them. Because if I did, I would not have enjoyed what would have happened next. You see, discipline is a sign of love. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 24 says it even more harshly. It says this, whoever spares the rod, that's discipline, hates their children. See, we think we're loving, but we're not. Whoever spares a rod, whoever does nothing, literally hates their children. Not emotionally, but in behavior, in action. But the one who loves their children is careful to discipline them. See, the thing is, redirecting can't fix everything. I wish it could. I love the redirecting language that's often used nowadays in school and parenting and all that, because there's an awful lot of times where a harsh discipline in previous generations was dealt out for something, and all that was being done there was childish behavior or a need to redirect or a need to refocus. But underneath it is a problem. Again, redirecting, I'm not saying is bad, but it can't fix everything. Modern parenting theories, if you think about it, they all assume one and the same thing, that we are born with pure hearts and pure motives. That a child comes into this world with a pure heart and pure motives. And it's the influences and all these things around it that turn us into the selfish pigs we can so easily become, that lead us to think the goofy thoughts we think and do the evil things we do. We're born with pure hearts and pure motives. So if that's true, then why would you ever do any kind of harsh discipline that really creates any kind of pain, more than a little appropriate timeout that they just get? Like, why would you do that? But the Bible paints a picture that's really opposite of that. The Bible paints a picture that we are born, since Adam and Eve, it's all their fault, we are born with a sinful heart and selfish motives. And we can argue the theories all day long. Well, the Bible says this. No, psychology says this. Here's what I want to do. Let's just look at real life. Every one of you that's ever been a parent, I want to know how many of you had to train your kid to be a selfish pig. How many of you had to train your kid to cry and whine when things weren't going the way they wanted? How many of you had to train your kid, say, you know what, like today we're going to learn how to lie. Today we're going to learn how to say mine, take it and grab it. We're going to learn how not to share. No, all of those things come naturally. Why? Because we are born with a sin nature. And the Bible says this, if we don't discipline our children, we're a willing party to their death. On your note sheet, there's Proverbs 19:18, which says that. Proverbs 22:15 says, folly, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, and it's the rod of discipline that will drive it far away. Now again, in this day and age, on such a sensitive subject, I've got to emphasize, I'm not talking about an angry lashing out. I'm talking about appropriate consequences. But I'm also trying to point out that appropriate consequences are not just a little talking to. And as the problems get bigger, they're not just a little time out. No pain, no gain. There really is a time and a place where the cost of doing wrong has to be greater than the pleasures of doing that wrong. Now that leads us to number four in David's list of how to goof up and fail parenting 101. And that is to ignore the obvious. Ignore the obvious. We see this pattern. We saw it in the 1 Kings chapter 1 verse I read. We saw it here in this passage where he was furious, but nobody said anything to anybody. That David looked the other way. It's as if he hoped his family problems would just go away with time. And you know what? We're going to see next weekend. No, they didn't go away in the silence of Absalom for 2 years. But I'm betting you at 1 year and 11 months, David kind of thought, well, this thing is passing over. Well, Tamar didn't. Absalom didn't. And we're going to find for Amnon, and didn't either. You can't ignore the obvious. Absalom also never said a word. It's like that was a whole family pattern. Absalom nor David. Here's a problem when there's an obvious issue in our family. If we ignore the elephant in the room, it doesn't go away. It just gets bigger. If I'm unwilling to talk about it with my kids or my spouse now, they're going to talk about it to someone else on a couch someday. That's just how it goes. And that elephant in the room can be the one kid that always is breaking all the rules. It can be the family member who is drinking too much or gambling too much or doing this or doing that. It can be the immorality somewhere. Most of our families, we've got some things we'd rather push into the closet. But the truth is, as I said earlier, they aren't hidden. And when we try to ignore the obvious, the key phrase is, it's obvious. And all that causes children to do is to wonder what's wrong with us that we're acting as something that's right out there in front of everybody isn't there. Now, there are some reasons why we let things go, especially in the parenting role with our kids. And again, I'm not talking about little stuff. I'm not talking about timeout stuff. I'm a little bit of redirecting and it's fine with a young kid. I'm talking about high-handed rebellion. There's three reasons why we let them go, or at least three very common reasons. And the first one is this. We have what I call misapplied love. We love our kids, but we misapply that love. And what happens is we think that love always lessens the pain. So what we do, I call it put a pan in the pants. The old days of a swat in the backside, you put a pan in the pants so the swat doesn't hurt too bad. And we think that's loving. We step in and we undercut the natural consequences. We can do it at school. We can do it with legal matters. We can do it in a neighborhood. We are always coming to the rescue because we think, well, they learned their lesson and we're undercutting the consequences. Listen, love forgives, but it doesn't always remove the consequences. Constantly bailing someone out only enables and lengthens the wrong behavior. And again, we're talking about wrong behavior. If every time I talk about it or I say nothing or whatever it would be, and my concept of love is I'm gonna put that pan in the pants and keep those consequences from happening, all I do is that psychological phrase, I empower them to do that more because they're not getting the consequences. And I lengthen it and make the problem bigger and bigger until finally it's so big I can't fix it. To use an analogy, it's kind of like if I had a kid who had a tendency to love to jump off things. So I'm always worried about that and trying to stop them, of course. And then what I do is I go and I get a bunch of mattresses and I put them all around the edge of my single-story house. So instead of punishing the kid for getting on the roof with enough of pain by whether it's a timeout or can't do or ground, whatever it would be, that they don't climb back on that roof, what I do is I just keep putting a bunch of mattresses out there so they don't get hurt. Well, all I'm teaching them is you jump off higher and higher things and you don't get hurt. And what I can pretty much guarantee is sooner or later, they're going to jump off 3 or 4 stories and that mattress ain't going to cut it. That's what happens when we misunderstand. And when we do that and we misapply love, what we actually do, we think we're helping the one, that we're protecting them from the consequences, but we're actually hurting the rest of our family, our spouse and any other kids. I see this all the time. I even see it with extended family where we have this sense of, wow, I need to protect, I need to help, I need to bail out, I need to do all this stuff to stop the consequences from happening. But it never dawns on us that we have a spouse, a husband or a wife that's suffering because of that. And we have kids. We're robbing them to take care of someone else. You know, there's a very instructive story in the Bible. It's Luke chapter 15, verses 11 to 31. Luke 15, 11, 31. I'm not sure if it's in your note sheet or not, but it's Luke 15, 11, 31. You've heard it enough times now. Look it up. It's a famous story of the prodigal son. And what the prodigal son does is in great arrogance, he's tired of being under his dad's thumb. He says, give me my half of the inheritance. And he goes off and he squanders it all. And then he's dead broke. He's eaten with the pigs, which was the ultimate low point for a Jewish boy. And, you know, kosher food. Like you're eating the pig's food, okay? You're not eating bacon. You're eating bacon's food. He comes to his senses and he comes back. His dad sees him, not because he was out there every day looking and looking for the son to come back, because the dad later on says, hey, he was dead to me. He was dead to me. But as he's out doing his work, he looks in the distance, and you've all had that happen where you recognize somebody's gait or whatever. He goes, oh my gosh, that's him. It is him. And then he runs and meets him. And he has a fatted calf killed, and he throws this incredible party. He gives him a ring. He gives him a robe, like, oh, wow. And then the good brother, who never rebelled, comes to Dad and says, Dad, this is terrible. I never did anything wrong, and this brother of mine, this son of yours, he went and squandered it all and wild living and prostitutes and all of this stuff, and you welcome him back with a party? You never threw no party for me. But it's so important. So we get on this on the brother saying, ah, what a bad attitude. And yeah, it's stinking attitude. But it's so important what the father says. He says, listen, your brother was dead. We've all moved on. But now he's back. I'm throwing a party. And all that I have is yours. In other words, I'm not cutting the inheritance in half again. See, that's what misapplied love would do. Well, you're back. Let's set you up with this. And nope, he'd wasted it all. And he's welcome back in the family. And good brother, calm down, because everything Dad has is still yours. But misapplied love would say, hey, brother, you need to understand. We need to give him a second chance. And whenever we step in and do that with the consequences, particularly when we do, you know, we're all going to do that once or twice. Maybe. When we do that as a pattern, we're not loving. We're hating, according to Proverbs, and we're making things worse. There's another angle of it, though. It's what I would call misplaced loyalty. Okay? We let things go sometimes and cover them up because of misplaced loyalty. Now, listen, family ties are incredibly important, but they can never be allowed to override justice. When my family ties become an excuse to cover up the sin of those I love, I become as guilty as a sinner. I'm an accomplice to the crime. That, by the way, was Eli's big problem. Who's Eli? Well, he was a high priest in the day of Samuel, who was a prophet that King Saul dealt with, the one who anointed David as the king. The high priest in that era, that time, was a guy named Eli. So in the beginning of 1 Samuel, the book we started this whole series in, I think we started verse 15. But if you went all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 2, you would find out about Eli and his sons. So he's a high priest. He's got an inheritance generation after generation of them being high priests, this privilege. But his sons were scoundrels. They had no regard for the Lord. They took the best part of the sacrifices that were to be burnt as an offering, and they stuck their fork in and took it for themselves. And when people rejected that and said, no, you can't do that, they did it by force. They slept with the women who served in the tabernacle. They were just absolute scoundrels. And Eli rebuked him with words, but he did nothing to restrain them. He failed to kick them out of the priesthood or carry out the proper justice because he misapplied family loyalty. And as a result, here's what happens. God took away his family heritage. In 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 13, I believe it's on your note sheet, Samuel is the one who addresses to Eli what's going to happen. And he says this, the Lord says this to Samuel. God says, for I told him I would judge his family forever. The priesthood's taken away. Why? Circle, highlight, underline. Because of the sin he knew about. His sons blasphemed God, and he failed to restrain them. You know, as we look at this story, some really bad things are going to happen between Absalom and Amnon, and the family's just torn apart. And Absalom, we're going to see, is going to feel the need to take matters into his own hands. And I think if we look at this passage, we realize if David had administered biblical justice to Amnon for the rape of his half-sister, and the Bible was quite clear what should happen to him, rather than go, he's my son, he's next in line of throne, and give him that break. If David had administered biblical justice to Amnon, Absalom would not have felt the need to take matters into his own hands and all the horror that flowed out of that later. Well, there's a third thing. It's wishful thinking. Sometimes we let things go because we have wishful thinking. It's a version of it would be what I call the good heart myth. You know, I remember watching on the news one time, a mom interviewed after her son's murder conviction, and she's got her tears, which are rather appropriate. But then these were her words. He's a good boy. He just got caught up in the wrong crowd. He's got a great heart. No. We are what we do. There's no sense of, well, I do really bad things, but a really good boy. No, really bad things, but a really good heart. The Bible's quite clear. Bad things don't flow out of a good heart. You don't agree with me? Well, you can argue with Jesus, because here's what he says. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart. And an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. What we do is a reflection of who we are on the inside. And the wishful thinking, well, that's not really them, when no, that is them, is one of the things that will cause us to cover up inappropriately, to hold back on justice, and at times just to let things go just within the household. We want to make sure we avoid that particular problem, ignoring the absolute obvious, because the elephant only gets bigger, bigger and bigger. Well, there's a fifth thing that David did. He provided a palace instead of presents. Not presents like at Christmas, but presents like being here. It's pretty obvious that David was an absentee parent. Now, I've got to give him a little bit of a break, because sometimes we read our culture into another culture. And you go back in history, and especially among royalty, you know, who's raising their children and all this. You didn't have the same kind of tight nuclear family that we've come to expect. But I want to guarantee you this. David seems to have been completely an absentee parent. And so the practical application for us is this, because most of us, first of all, aren't providing a palace. But here's the application. There's a myth of quality time. And it doesn't do any good if you want to be a parent, if you're providing all kinds of stuff, but you're not providing you. The myth of quality time says, I'm not going to be around much emotionally or physically or whatever, but when I'm around, I'm a Disneyland dad or a Disneyland mom, man. I'm like all here. And here's the problem. Quality flows out of quantity. Quality flows out of quantity. You can't schedule quality time. Some of you have done that. Some of you from broken homes where you've got a custody issue, you know what it's like. You try to schedule the quality time, and sometimes it just doesn't work. You know, you can't ask your kid, like, tell me the game you're going to hit a home run. Tell me the time you're going to do this. Tell me what day you're going to come home from school totally devastated so I can make sure I'm there. Quality flows out of quantity. And what I find more often than not, is this. Emotional absence is a form of selfishness. Now, certainly, we're going to go through that at times where we're all stressed out or this or that or happens. But I'm talking about long-term, not seasonal, not a period of life, but long-term emotional absence. It's a form of selfishness. And it's usually more about climbing my personal career ladder than it is about what I call it, providing for my family. Oh, I really work hard. I know I'm not there as much as I should be, but I'm just providing for my family. And what I want to challenge some of you that are living there and you're emotionally absent, you're pretty much physically absent a ton of time, be very careful, because you're not providing for your family. More often than not, you're just climbing your own personal career ladder. And then you justify it with, I'm providing for my family. Because what David needed to provide for his family was his presence. His not ignoring the obvious. His actual discipline, and instead of just flowing up in anger, and what he really owed them was a great, great example. And so I told you at the beginning, what I was going to do is we're going to look at these five things David did. And please, as I always tell you, these are not binoculars, so you can look at all the other families at North Coast and our campuses and our workplace and friends. This is a mirror to see where each of us could maybe improve. Or if you're not, don't have kids, the people we get to counsel, the people we get to encourage, the people whose lives we get to speak into. Learn these things for that. But I also want to give you a better plan. Like, well, what do I practically do? Now, on your note sheet and online, we've got a couple of things that you can follow up in much greater detail later this week. There's a conversation about parenting that we recorded, that being the only legacy that really matters. And then Pastor Chris and myself, we've got a couple of daily doses that you're going to find in your note sheet and you're going to find online as well as ways to follow up and go, well, what does it look like to do the opposite part of this? And there's a lot that can be said there. But Jesus was one time asked, out of the 613 laws in the Old Testament, what's the most important? Well, they're all important, or God wouldn't have put them there. But when he's asked, if you had to sum it up, what would you do? He really summed it up in something pretty simple. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor like you love yourself. Done. So I thought of that this week, and I thought, what is a way in which I could sum up a lot of things I could talk about in terms of parenting, like, have you tried this, do this, or whatever. And I think this sums it up, not to put myself like Jesus, but it sums it up pretty well if you said, like, what is the one thing I could do to pass with a good grade parenting 101? And here it is. The most powerful biblical model is so simple and straightforward. Simply be an open book you want your kids to read. That's it. Be an open book you want your kids to read. Let them see, let them know, talk to them about what's going on, and live the life you want them to live. It's the one thing that'll have more impact than all the recipes and watering schedules we could ever give you about how to be a parent. Now, it doesn't guarantee your kids will walk with Jesus. We've already addressed that. But I want to tell you, it mightily increases the odds. You know, Nancy and I, looking back, we probably did a lot of wrong things according to all the recipes in all the books and the conferences about raising kids. But I want to tell you, there's one thing I look back with no regrets on. And that is we did a good job of walking the path we wanted our kids to walk someday. And in the Old Testament, there's actually two passages that speak about this. The Bible puts it this way. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 to 9. It's also found in chapter 11. These commands that I give you today are to be on your hearts, impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up the next morning. What's he saying there? Again, he repeats it. Moses repeats it in Deuteronomy 11 as well. He's simply saying, know the law of God, live the law of God, let your kids see the law of God being lived, and along the way, be an open book that explains why you do what you do. I want to tell you that will run circles around family devotions. That'll run circles around homeschooling, Christian schooling, putting them in the proper public school, whatever it would be. All of those things might be assets to what God has called you to do, but none of them will ever be as powerful as a simple thing of living as an open book, the life you and I want our kids to live. And if that's not what we've been living, guess what? Today's the first day of the rest of your life. Go home and start it now. Because what we are is what we'll get. Father, would you take these things and would you encourage our hearts with what you've called us to do in the simplicity of laying down that example that David didn't lay down? And the other things that we've talked about, would you nudge us where your spirit needs to nudge us, that we would be the parents, the grandparents, the friends, the advisors you would want us to be for your glory and your fame. In Jesus' name, amen.
Wow, there's some amazing parenting material in today's message. And if you're like me, I can use all the help that I can get with my two little girls. That's why we want to come alongside and pray for any needs that you might have. Simply text that prayer request into this phone number right here on your screen, and we will be praying over those needs this week. Well, as I mentioned earlier, we're trying to establish a new way for us to be able to interact. And one of those ways is through social media. We encourage you, go to Instagram, follow us North Coast Online or on Facebook. And then as you do, go ahead and post where you might be watching from around the country. We'd love to be able to see those pictures and be able to interact with you. Well, thank you once again for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you next week.